Any event, I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about the cutting edge of where we are in theoretical physics. And so I just wanted to comment that any resemblance to this individual is purely coincidental. So the title of my talk is The Superstring Adventure. And as Damien said, I'm going to talk a little bit about superstring theory. One of the observations about superstring theory is that it seems to be something that's already infiltrated the popular culture. There's a cartoon here from a New Yorker magazine several years back. There are also a number of books for the general public that have been written. I guess you had some homework coming from Brian Greene's book over there. I also line them up. These are the guys who think that superstring theory is a great idea. There are also people who think it's not such a great idea. You can guess on which side I'm going to come. But superstring theory, as I said, it's at the cutting edge, or it's at the forefront of theoretical physics. And so the story of superstring theory is really a story about moving forward. But to understand superstring theory, or where we are and where we're going, it's a good idea to look back to see where we've come from. And so I'm going to start with sort of a historical introduction. And so the observation here is that the 20th century really marked a revolution in the way that people understand the physical universe. And there was an enormous progress in our points of view and the ideas and the theories that we use. But there's also a key word up here that's illustrated, is that that progress came through a synthesis of bringing together different ideas. And so here's this picture of various areas of physics, various areas of research, and a set of arrows describing how they came together. And so that's a nice picture, but to really understand what it means, I just wanted to focus on one part of that picture and say a few more words about it. So here we have three ideas. At the top, we had electromagnetism, thermodynamics, and somehow they joined together to make quantum mechanics. Well, the idea there is that thermodynamics, well, that's the science of studying things that when they get hot. And so this was really the high tech of the 19th century. The goal or a major aim there was to build more powerful, faster steam engines. And you know, that advanced industry, transportation, all sorts of things like that. But at the beginning, the late 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, Mr. Maxwell also was, you know, making headway with electromagnetism. And so in particular, we learned that, you know, ideas or magnets and circuits or electricity, those were actually two pieces of the same thing known as electromagnetism. And when we brought them together and we had Maxwell's equations, we learned about we were able to understand in a better way the idea of light and radio waves and the electromagnetic spectrum. And so as I presented it then, these two are very different ideas. Over here we have steam engines, over here we have magnets. And so how do these things come together? Well, it's a very simple idea. We all know that if we heat things up very, very hot, then they start to glow, they start to emit light, or they start to emit electromagnetic radiation. And so when things are extremely hot, we get into a regime where we have to understand both sides of this picture and put them together in a common, to answer questions about a common problem. And so that was really what this arrow represents. And there were, when we naively tried to bring these two areas together, it led to a number of puzzles in understanding the spectrum that's appearing in the light that's being shining from these hot objects. And ultimately, that's what led us to a new way of thinking about light, new way of thinking about atoms. And that came under the heading of quantum mechanics. And of course, quantum mechanics is something then that moved forward, and it's really, you know, it was a rich source of new ideas, and it gave rise to, well, it's largely the basis of all of modern technology. So that's sort of, in more detail, what's behind all these little arrows. what happens is we had two sets of ideas that seemed to be talking about completely different pieces of physics, but in certain areas we had to bring both of those ideas together, and that led us to then understanding some extra feature or some new way of thinking about the physical universe. At the bottom here, these are then the forefront of 20th century physics. Our understanding of the physical universe at the turn of the century really rests on these two cornerstones or these two pillars. There's general relativity and something I call quantum field theory, which is sort of the ancestor or the daughter of quantum mechanics. And so, well, what are those ideas really about? Because in some sense, they're going to be players in today's discussion. Well, general relativity really goes back to one individual here, Mr. Einstein. And what he, well, this was part of that 20th century revolution. The first thing he did is he formulated a theory known as special relativity, in which he realized that space and time are actually linked together in an entity that we now know as space-time. But then he, in trying to link together these ideas of special relativity with gravity, he realized that the way that happens is that space-time is actually an object that has dynamics, or it can be a floppy object. And so in general relativity, he described gravity as a geometric or a manifestation of the space-time geometry. And so there's a little picture here. The space-time that we live in is mostly flat, and so lines are straight. But you can imagine, or mathematicians can draw these pictures for us, and we can imagine in curved space-times, even though people try or think they're moving in straight lines, those straight lines don't behave in the same way that they do here in the flat geometry. And so the slogan up here is that it's all just straight lines. When we're moving around in a gravitational field, we think we're moving in a straight, or our, the physical description is motion in a straight line, but that straight line is in a curved space-time. So general relativity, that was then realizing or describing gravity in this geometric framework gave rise to all sorts of new ideas. It gave rise to the idea of a black hole, a region of space-time where the gravitational field is so strong that even light can't escape. The idea that there are gravitational waves, in the same way that there are electromagnetic waves, there can be ripples in the geometry of space-time that propagate out. And it also gave rise at some level, or gave birth to the idea or the science of cosmology and our description of the universe or the evolution of the universe as a whole. But it wasn't just that general relativity gave us all sorts of new ideas. The reason that it really caught hold in science is that it was also rigorously tested. And there's a whole list of different precision tests of light in a gravitational field, or the orbit of a certain planet in the sun's gravitational field, which really confirmed, or general relativity made predictions, and they were confirmed by these experiments. And so that's really why we why scientists believe in general relativity. And so here's an example of one of those tests. So these dots are very precise measurements of the orbit of two orbiting distant stars that emit very strong electromagnetic fields. And then the curved line is the prediction of general relativity. And you can see that they're lying one on top of the other. And while that's a simple graph or a simple picture, the experiment to make those measurements so precisely is a real tour de force, and it earned these gentlemen here a Nobel Prize in 1993. In fact, general relativity is something that surprisingly plays a role in everyday life now. We all know about global positioning systems. We can buy devices like this for our car. And in fact, with those devices, we're able to position ourselves on a map within a distance of something like a meter. But to be able to get that kind of precision, we have to take into account the effects of general relativity and special relativity for that system to work so well. So then to summarize, general relativity, it was a rich source of new ideas. It's also rigorously tested in experiments. And so it gave us this new vision of gravity. It provided us with a geometric picture or a geometric arena with which to describe physics on the very large scales. Here we're talking about gravitational fields, so we're talking about motions of planets and stars, perhaps the evolution or the motions within a galaxy or the universe, the entire universe itself. Now, general relativity, I said, was the idea of Albert Einstein. And these gentlemen here won a Nobel Prize. It's perhaps ironic that Einstein himself won a Nobel Prize not for this contribution to science, but for contributions in understanding the microscopic world. And that's really the arena of quantum mechanics. And so I see by the notes here that you've been hearing a little bit about quantum mechanics. But this is a very different then picture of the physical universe. It's a description or a theory that speaks in terms of probabilities, in terms of waves, in terms of uncertainties. But these are all features of physics or phenomena on very small scales. And so one of the ideas you may have heard about is that particles can act like waves. And so there's this simple formula that was written down by de Broglie in the 1930s. And it says that any particle with a certain momentum can be assigned a wavelength or a wave-like character. And the conversion constant here is something known as Planck's constant. Now, one can do a calculation with this formula and assign a wavelength, a quantum wavelength, for a raindrop falling out of the sky. And you get some ridiculously small number. And I just want to emphasize what a ridiculously small number that is. It's a lot of zeros there behind the decimal point before you get to that four. But the raindrop itself is an object that has a size. I mean, I can look at a raindrop and it's going to be a millimeter or a couple millimeters across. And so if I'm doing an experiment, well, here I've described it in terms of a water jet, but we might think about holding a screen up over the floor in a rainstorm. But the water droplets, when they hit the screen, there are two slits here, and so some of the water droplets go through this side, some of the water droplets go through that side, and you'll get a wet spot behind that slit and another wet spot over there. And so that's the behavior we expect of those water droplets or of those particles. And this wave-like character just doesn't play a role because this number is just so ridiculously small compared to a millimeter or the size of the water droplets themselves. However, we can scale that same thing down, and rather than thinking about water droplets, we can think about an electron, say. And so it's not hard to construct a system where I'm accelerating, again, electrons in some beam. And with reasonable energies, though, the wavelength that I get, in that case, is going to be 10 to the minus 10 meters. Or that's a nice scale that describes the scale at which atomic physics is done. And so we've invented a new set of units, the angstrom there. But you can see that, well, this was a small object, and it had a ridiculously small wavelength. For the electron, this is still a much smaller number than the kind of number that we're used to thinking about. But it's a smaller object, a smaller particle to begin with, but the wavelength here has become larger. And on this scale, I can actually manufacture interesting experiments. Rather than an ordinary screen, I'd have some kind of foil here, and I can micro manufacturer, I can put slits in that foil. And then if I put that in front of my electron beam, instead of getting just a spot over here behind that slit and another spot over here, in fact, what I can find is that this wave-like character plays a role. And so here on the screen, what I get is an interference pattern that so shows a whole series of peaks and valleys. And so the important message to take away is that this quantum behavior, this wave-like behavior, is something that becomes manifest at the subatomic or the atomic scale of things. So quantum theory is a very different perspective on nature, but it's a perspective that we can apply when we're talking about things of atomic sizes or subatomic sizes. And so, well, where have we pushed that small scale picture of the universe? Well, again, 10 to the minus 10, that was the size of an atom. And so what we realized there was that we had some very heavy nucleus in the center, and then the electrons formed orbitals or wave-like structures around that nucleus. However, if we turn up the resolution by a few orders of magnitude, when we get down to 10 to the minus 14 meters, what we realize is that this nucleus at the center actually has structure itself. It's composed of protons and neutrons. I can crank up the resolution again, and what we realize is that these protons and neutrons have substructure. They're actually composed of three particles known as quarks. And so an individual, I guess that's a proton, would be composed of what's known as two up quarks and a down quark. And so the maximum resolution that we've attained with various experiments is of the order of 10 to the minus 17 meters. And at that scale, what we've seen in nature is there's not just the electron, but then there are a number of heavier versions of the electron known as the tau and the muon. These guys also come with various partners or their related particles known as neutrinos. They're the quarks I described up there, the up, down. There's a whole series of those now that we know about, strange, charm, bottom, top. And so that's what I call, well, these are all labeled fermions. You can think of this as the matter in nature. There are also a bunch of forces in nature, and so those forces also are in quantum field theory are described by certain particles or quanta. And so there was electromagnetism. The quanta there is known as the photon. The forces holding these quarks together are known as, or that's the strong force, and the force carriers are known as gluons. There's another force known as the weak force. It has to do with various kinds of radioactive decay, and the force carriers there have very boring names, the Z and the W plus, the W minus. And so we have these catalogs of different kinds of particles, but what we also know is that those particles interact in very specific ways. And so what's been built up is what's known as the standard model of subatomic physics. And so it puts, it combines these two catalogs in a very specific way, or it describes the interactions of those particles. And so there's a number of free parameters, but those are things that we can go measure, for instance, the mass of an electron, say, or the decay rate, the rate or the interaction strength here would tell us how quickly one of these W's would decay into, say, an electron and a neutrino. So again, quantum theory is something that gave us, well, a new perspective on the universe, but again, one of the reasons that people are so enamored by it is that it also makes predictions, and those predictions are tested various rigorously in various experiments. So one of the most, well, in my mind, a remarkable example is the magnetic moment of various subatomic particles. In particular, an electron, I said that it's a particle, but it's actually something that has a spin, and I can assign a magnetic moment to it. So I can think of an electron is a tiny little magnet. And in the simplest case, in a theory put forward by Dirac in the 1930s, well, the magnetic moment is described by some combination of various parameters, but there's a number here, this G, and in Dirac's theory, G is precisely equal to 2. However, when you make measurements, it's not precisely equal to 2. Turns out that quantum fluctuations lead to a small deviation from this number from being precisely 2. And you can do calculations and measurements to determine the precision, or to determine the deviation from precisely 2. And so if I make some kind of an experiment where I measure the magnetic moment of an electron, I get a number that's not just 2, it's 2.023, blah, 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 all those numbers. The theorists can also go away with the quantum theory, and they can calculate what they expect that number to be. And what they find is that the number should be 2.0023, da, 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 da. They're looking pretty good, but if you pay attention, right down there at the end, those numbers start to deviate. And so what that means, though, is that there's an agreement to one part in 10 to the 10 between what we measure in nature and what we have calculated. I want to emphasize that it's not really that there's a discrepancy at this point. What's true is that, you know, any experiment, there's a certain amount of error or a certain amount of precision with which you can claim your measurement. And so this is really in the error bars. To get a more precise measurement, I'd have to invest, a few million dollars extra in my experiment and a lot of time. And I might be able to extract an extra digit or two here. In the same way, this calculation is a calculation that took place over it's probably on the order of 30 years. And at this point, you're actually engaging in doing numerical calculations on computers. And again, it's not a matter that, you know, we are absolutely sure what those numbers are. It's a calculation, and you're carrying it out order by order. And if we wanted to invest the time, we could, and, you know, start to extract extra digits there. So this discrepancy is just the limitations of the human effort that's been, exerted in doing both this calculation and this measurement in the experiment. This slide is just to emphasize that that's only one example. There are other famous examples, for example, something to do with the energy levels in the hydrogen atom. This one perhaps is a little less impressive, but again, there are 6 significant figures of agreement. And again, it's a matter of how much effort one is going to expend in really carrying out the calculations and doing the experiment. So there are rigorous tests of quantum theory, and of course, quantum theory is a rich source of new ideas. I mentioned that, you know, basically all of modern technology is based on various effects in quantum theory. So there's semiconductor technology, there are lasers, electron microscopy, MRI, pure superfluid superconductors. In fact, what I did to make up that list is I went to the Nobel Prize webpage and just scanned down various prizes that have been awarded in the past 50 years. And, you know, all or many of these ideas are new ideas that were seen worthy of a Nobel Prize. Okay, so again, we've got a new perspective on the small scale features of the physical universe. Quantum theory being a source of new ideas and also something that's been subjected to rigorous tests. And so we have this marvelous description of nature on the small scale. But there's something missing here. And what's, oh my gosh. Okay, no, sorry. We'll get back to that. Sorry about that. There's this strange catalogs of particles over here, of force carriers over here. You know, why should the universe have so many different constituents? And that's really where string theory first came into play in physics. What theoretical physicists were looking for was a way, again, to unify things. And so what they wanted to do was unify all of these different particles and put them in a simple framework. And the idea is that string theory contained this long list of particles. But here we're looking at nature at this particular resolution. The idea is if I look at a much higher resolution, 10 to the minus 35 meters, in fact, what I'll see is that these different particles are actually different aspects of a certain kind of string. And so an electron might be an electron, or it might be distinguished from a photon because the string might vibrate or it might rotate in a different way. But because the string now is an extended object, it has lots of internal degrees of freedom. And so the quantum numbers or the labels we use to distinguish an electron from a photon can just be represented as different internal degrees of freedom of the string. And so, the basic idea is that if I look with sufficient resolution, all of the different particles we see in nature would be different kinds of this single species of string. Well, I said that not only did we have a catalog of different particles, we had a set of interactions. And so what about interactions in string theory? Well, how do strings interact? There's a very simple geometric picture. If I have two strings, they can come. And then if they happen to cross or touch at a certain point, the ends there can interchange. And so those two loops can become one. And so you get a picture like this. In fact, we can all do string theory with our hands. Basically, what we have then are two loops. They touch at a point and expand into one. Alternatively, if I have a big loop and it crosses over itself, that loop can also divide up. And so I can run this process in the opposite direction. I can have a big loop that falls apart into two smaller loops. And so there's a, given this picture of strings or extended object, this is a simple geometric interaction. Again, this is quantum theory, and so there's a certain coupling constant that determines sort of the probability that this process takes place. In practice, what that's saying is that sometimes the strings will touch and they'll just pass through each other. But with a certain probability, namely, well, basically that parameter g, I'll actually get this interaction where the ends or the pieces of string rearrange themselves to form, well, join two loops into one big loop. Okay, so what we have then is a theory with strings. It's got lots of internal degrees of freedom, and so I can describe different particles. I can also, I've got a simple geometric interaction. And so if I put that all together, it turns out that with those simple rules, I can produce all of, or I have a framework that's sufficient then to describe all of the particles and interactions that we see in the standard model. So that seems like a really nice idea then. Of course, what I've given you is a very superficial picture of string theory. I apologize. And so there's more to it than that. In particular, when I look at this catalog, on this side, what I said is these are the forces that we see in nature. And so what's missing in that picture? Well, I started the talk, or earlier in the talk, what I was mentioning was gravity. So, you know, I don't see gravity on that list, but we certainly know that that's a force in nature. In this quantum theoretic framework, there's a force carrier that's aptly named the graviton that should appear in this list. Well, as I said, gravity's really a player, or, you know, it really governs physics at the largest scale. It turns out I didn't put it in my standard model list simply because it's irrelevant for the experiments that we were doing at this scale here. And yet, what we feel is that this is just another force in nature, and so we should be able to combine that with this physics up here. And that's really one of the exciting aspects of superstring theory. It turns out that not only does superstring theory have the right features to describe the standard model of particle physics, it's also a theory of gravitational physics. In fact, consistency of the theory demands that I have a graviton. So it's not just that I have the choice of putting it there or not putting it there. In fact, a consistent string theory always has a graviton. But even better than that, if I look at, remember we were talking about strings being things that had a very tiny size, but if I look at the physics of string theory on much, much longer distance scales, what I get is a theory that reproduces basically Einstein's theory of gravity. So I get some equation that looks like this. On this side, what I have is some terms or some symbols describing the geometry of space-time. And on this side, we have another set of symbols that describe basically how that geometry interacts with the matter or the standard model particles, the electrons. And so superstring theory is then something that naturally unifies the theory of the small scales, the quantum field theory or the standard model, and general relativity. And in fact, there's a coupling constant here, Newton's constant. So that's the constant that we know about in all the textbooks. That's the same as the one in Newton's laws. But that's a coupling constant, or it determines the strength of an interaction in something that I'm describing with string theory. And so it turns out that Newton's constant then is related to the parameters of the string theory. And in particular, this string scale, or the scale at which strings, the size of strings become manifest, is related to Newton's constant. And there's some conversion constants, the speed of light, and Planck's constant, that are just fundamental constants. But basically, they provide us a conversion between Newton's constant that we know about from Cavendish experiments and this hypothetical string scale. And that's really where I came up with the number 10 to the minus 35 as the size or the scale at which string physics would become manifest. It's because I know all of these numbers here. String theory tells me that those numbers are related to the parameters of string theory. And so if we're going to describe our universe or our physics, then it had better be true that this scale be 10 to the minus 35. And I remind you, that's an enormously small scale. It's about 17 or 18 orders of magnitude away from the resolution that we're at which we're doing experiments right now. Okay, so superstring theory then is bringing together these two ideas. And so basically then the hope is that this is the next step in theoretical physics. Remember that we had this picture where various ideas came together, and we were left with these two cornerstones at the end of the 20th century. The hope is that what we're doing with superstring theory is, again, unifying those two ideas and putting them together in a single theoretical framework. Now, of course, what I gave you was a very superficial picture of string theory. And as it says there, the devil is in the details. So in particular, one of the predictions of string theory is that space-time actually has 10 dimensions. However, if we look around us, what we actually see are only 4 dimensions. And I'll remind you that I'm counting as a theoretical physicist 4 here, because there are 3 spatial dimensions. So there's forward, left, right, up for my spatial dimensions. But then there's also time. And Einstein said that space and time are on equal footing. So we see 4, string theory wants 10. Well, maybe we just haven't looked hard enough yet. Maybe what it is the 6 extra dimensions are curled up on a scale, perhaps the string scale, to a size that's just beyond the resolution of present day experiments. And just as an image of how that works, we can think of the tightrope walker here. When she thinks of the tightrope is a one-dimensional object. She can either move forward or she can move backward. But if I have a better resolution, say of this ant or this bug here, the bug sees the rope as in fact a two-dimensional object or a two-dimensional surface. The bug can follow the tightrope walker forward or backward. But she can also, or the bug can also move to the left and the right and move around the circumference of the cord. And so in this picture here, we have a similar idea that there are the dimensions that we observe or experience in our everyday life. But then the 6 extra dimensions are curled up in some strange geometry which we're only going to be able to probe with some very high energy or some very short wavelength experiments. However, I wanted to emphasize that those six extra dimensions, it's not a surplus of riches. In fact, it's an essential feature of the string theory. And that's what I really wanted to illustrate with this picture. If I think about the string theory that I described to you, it was a very simple theory. It had a single scale, the string scale, which was a size at which the string theory became, or the strings became manifest. And it had a single coupling constant associated with this simple geometric interaction. However, if I look at the physics, you know, that we experience in our universe, in fact, it's a physical universe that shows us many, many different scales, many, many different interactions. And so if string theory was a four-dimensional theory, it would be dead in the water right away, because it wouldn't have the complexity or the richness to be able to describe the physics that we observe in our universe. And it's really only because I have these extra dimensions that that extra richness becomes manifest in the observable universe. But it becomes a different perspective on things. Rather than writing down different parameters in my theory, what I'm doing is I'm engineering different geometries with which I curl up those six extra dimensions. And depending on the details of that geometry, what I produce is low energy physics or four-dimensional physics that describes or realizes different kinds of forces and different kinds of scale. So again, this is just to emphasize that string theory is really, well, the six extra dimensions here are really an essential feature of the string theory. More details. Well, the super and superstring theory comes from something called supersymmetry. Supersymmetry says that for each one of these fermions, so those were the things that I called the matter particles, there's a partner that's a boson. Those were the things that I called the force particles. And they have labels or they have properties that should be very, very similar. If I look at the standard model catalog, in fact, the bosons and the fermions have very different properties. And so though we can't, well, supersymmetry can't be connecting those, and so there must be extra particles in nature that, again, we haven't seen. Of course, the big fix, perhaps we should just be looking harder. We should be looking to higher energies, to shorter resolutions, to unveil or to realize these different particles. Again, supersymmetry has a certain benefit. It's supersymmetry that really tames certain quantum fluctuations at the very shortest distance scales. It's this that's essential to unifying geometric picture of gravity that Einstein's general relativity gives us with a standard quantum understanding of short distance scales. Another detail, this is more a conceptual or perhaps philosophical detail, is that over the, I guess it was the 80s and the early part of the 90s, people looked or were exploring superstring theory, and what they found is that there were different ways to construct the string theory. And so those different string theories come with different labels. There's a type 1 theory, a type 2A, a type 2B. Something called E8 cross E8 or SO32. If we want to say that superstring theory is the theory describing our universe, well, we only have one universe. Doesn't that mean that we have four too many different string theories? Well, there was a shift in the mid 80s on a change of the paradigm. And from that emerged a certain conjecture known as the M-theory conjecture. And that conjecture is that these different mathematical constructions that we knew as different string theories are actually different phases or different solutions of a single fundamental theory. And so that theory is now labeled as M theory. And so again, it's this idea of unification that in fact these are just different aspects of some simpler underlying theory. So I wanted to give you some, I can't really in this lecture describe where the M theory conjecture comes from, but I wanted to give you some of the basic ingredients or basic ideas. So one buzzword that you run into is the buzzword known as duality. And so duality is basically, well, as I say there, I've got two sets of mathematics that look very, very different. But if I interpret that mathematics in terms of physical phenomena, what I find is that these different mathematical pictures give me the same physical phenomena. And so there's actually a relatively simple picture, or one of these dualities that I'm going to try and explain to you. And so there's something known as T-duality, again, a funny name. But what it says is that string theory on different kinds, well, remember I was compactifying or curling up some of the extra dimensions. And so T-duality says that if I curl up a string theory with a large circle or with a small circle, in fact, those two theories, although, well, they're different from that perspective, from the perspective of the geometry, I'm calling one a large circle, one a small circle. But the idea is that the physics or the string theory is actually the same. So in fact, I'm going to pick two circles with very specific radii or circumferences. So here the circumference is given by a radius r, 2 pi r. Here the circumference is given, or the radius is given by the string scale squared divided by r. So remember, if this is a macroscopic number, say 1 millimeter, this was something of the order of 10 to the minus 35 meters. And so this particular circumference is tiny. It's much smaller, in fact, than the string scale. So how does the physics work here? Well, remember that quantum theory gave us this idea of a de Broglie wavelength. It looked something like this. It said that given a momentum, I can associate it with a wavelength. I'm going to butcher that formula a little bit for you. First of all, I'm going to throw away the conversion constants. I'm not going to pay attention to H bars or C's. They're all going to be hidden as far as the discussion here goes. I'm also going to use an idea that Einstein introduced us to, again, related to the speed of light being a universal conversion constant. And so I've replaced the momentum here with an energy. So for different energies then of particles, I'm associating different wavelengths. Now here I've got a circle. If I want to set up a consistent particle here, what I want to do is I want to set up a standing wave. And so in order to do that, what has to be true is that the circumference has to be an integral number of wavelengths so that I get a finite or a fixed number of vibrations around that circle. Well, then I just apply, well, this is the size of a circle. I just apply this de Broglie wavelength. And so what that does is it relates an energy with the radius. And then there's some integer there telling me how many vibrations there are. And so for this circle, then, I can get a spectrum of energies associated with these different vibrations that's just given by n divided by the circumference. And if I was doing things properly, there'd be H bars and C's hidden in that formula, but I claim I don't care. Now on this side, well, I'm getting the same result, but the radius that I'm using here is just LS squared divided by R. And so if I take the inverse of that, I get a formula that looks like that. So if I was doing field theory, if I was doing standard model physics, that would be the whole story. You know, a photon could have a certain set of vibrations here, a different set of vibrations there, and the two spectra, they're just different. And so this geometry and that geometry are clearly distinguished. However, what we're doing is string theory. With string theory, I can do something else. What I can do is I can take a string and I can stretch it all the way around the circle. And so in fact, I can wrap it around here many, many times. And that'll give me another set of energies. what I'm doing is I'm taking a string. It's got a certain energy density or tension. And so there's some characteristic of the strings. I'm wrapping it around the circumference of the circle. And I can wrap it around, again, some integer number of times. Some details there. So the string tension or the energy density is related, again, to this string scale. Remember, that's the only fundamental scale in the theory. And so this energy density, it turns out, again, up to H bars and C's is just given by 1 over the string scale squared. And there happens to be a factor of 2 pi there. Again, here's the formula for the circumference of the circle. And so if I put that together, what I get is a set of winding states for strings, where I have a number of windings around the circle. I have then the radius, and then this factor came from the string tension. Here, I'm going to do the same set of calculations, but I use that combination as the radius. And so when I put it together, I get this expression here. So in string theory, then, I've got two sets of energies that I can associate with a geometry like that. One set of wave-like excitations, one set of winding excitations, where I'm just stretching a string. So here, if I compare the total spectrum, this and that, with what I'm getting on this side, this and that, there's a remarkable result. In fact, this spectrum is identical to that spectrum. But on this side, where I have wave-like excitations, those are represented by winding excitations around the small circle. And similarly, the winding excitations here turn out to be associated with momentum or wave-like excitations on this side. And so that says, even though field theory thinks those are two different geometries, if I'm doing string theory and I curl up a dimension in these two different ways, in fact, the string theory can't tell the difference between those two. And so in fact, T-duality says that string theory on this big circle here is identical to string theory on that side. In fact, there are, again, a lot more details, but this gives you a flavor for where this idea comes from. Another ingredient that went into the M-theory conjecture is that suddenly we realized that string theory is not just a theory of strings. In fact, there are lots of other objects, extended objects, and they're known as D-brains. D stands for Dirichlet. And so it turns out that you can have brains or objects that are extended in any number of dimensions. So in fact, there are particles or zero brains. They have no extent in spatial direction. There are things that are extended in one dimension. Those are strings. And then there are things that can be extended in two dimensions. That has a popular name. That's like a membrane. But in fact, remember that we're working in 10 dimensions. And so you can extend things in lots of extra directions. And in general here, someone came up with a clever name that those are just P brains, where P is a number standing for the number of different ways that it's extended in my 10 spatial dimensions. Now, it seems kind of funny that if we've been studying string theory for some 20 years or 25 years, that at a certain point, we suddenly realize that, hey, wait a minute, it's not just a string theory, but there's all this other crap in the theory. Where were those for the first 25 years? Well, in fact, the reason that we were ignoring those is, remember that I said there was a coupling constant. And the way we understood the theory is by, or made headway in understanding the theory, is by saying that the interactions were weak, or that the coupling constant was small. That way, the interactions between the individual strings only happens occasionally. And one can work, relatively easily, because most of the times, the strings are doing nothing. They're not interacting strongly. And so if you look at the energy densities or the tensions associated with these different kinds of objects, well, again, they're governed by the two parameters of the theory, the coupling constant and the string scale. But notice that in some sense, they're what are known as non-perturbative objects. Rather than a G in the numerator, there's a 1 over G. And so if I treat G as being very, very small, these are huge energy densities. And so they're things that I'm not naturally going to excite when I study these perturbative or do these perturbative calculations. So So at weak coupling, which is where we were studying or trying to understand string theory, these are extremely heavy objects. And so that's why they went unnoticed, or they were thought to be unimportant. However, of course, if G becomes very large, I get into a regime of strong coupling where the strings are always interacting. It turns out these become lighter and lighter, and so they can play an extremely important role at strong coupling. And so understanding that feature is one of the things that allowed us to connect different theories or different phases of string theory, because sometimes what I'm connecting is one string theory at weak coupling, in fact, looks like or gives me the same physics as another string theory at strong coupling. Okay. So that then gave rise to this M-theory conjecture, where all of the known string theories then, well, we understand how to connect different kinds of string theories. So for example, the 2A and the 2B are connected by this 2 duality that I described, and there are other dualities that connect those other corners. If you paid attention before, I talked about five string theories, and what I'm showing you there is a hexagon. So there's an extra corner. Turns out that M theory also seems to naturally incorporate another kind of a theory that, in fact, is an 11-dimensional theory. Remember, here I said that I found 10-dimensional string theories. This guy up here, the duality is strange enough that it takes me from a 10-dimensional picture to an 11-dimensional picture. Okay, so here we have our string theory or M theory, perhaps the foundation. You know, I've replaced superstring theory by M theory. The idea is that this should unify these different ideas and provide the pillar on which we can understand all aspects of the physical universe. And it's certainly true that M theory has been a rich source of new ideas, and that's a feature that it holds in common with both general relativity and quantum field theory. It's giving us a new perspective on how to understand things. On the other hand, in the 20th century, when we made progress here, it was essential that we were guided by experiments. Remember up here, I said that the reason we were forced to think about unifying those is because we observed in nature, when we heat things up, they start to glow. So where are we going to get guidance to unify these two theories and decide precisely what the nature of M theory is, or what kind of compactification, or how to curl up the extra six dimensions? Remember, I said here I'm thinking about physics at the largest scales. Here I'm thinking about physics at small scales. It turns out that you can look at those two and you can realize that if I'm going to run into a conflict, it's going to be at this scale known as the Planck scale, or essentially the scale that I wrote before, or I understood here in this theory as the string scale. It says that something new has to happen at 10 to the minus 35 meters. Now, what M theory says is I'll start to see strings or different kinds of brains, but is that a physics that we can see or we can realize in some experiment in the lab? Well, no. So how's that going to work? Well, here's an ungenerous summary of string theory. It's an awesome idea, but what does it really mean? I don't know. In fact, string theorists are working harder than that. And so string theory is looking, I mean, we realize that the way forward is to get guidance from experiment. And so there are different ways in which one might hope that that occurs. One is sort of the standard evolution of quantum physics or high energy physics is to build bigger and bigger experiments, bigger particle colliders or bigger accelerators. And so there's a new accelerator that's just going online. There's a new experiment that's going to start this year in Geneva known as the Large Hadron Collider. And so it's going to study a new energy regime or give us a look at nature at a shorter resolution than ever has ever been looked at before. And so, well, one feature is that, you know, we're going, you know, one or two orders of magnitude better in resolution. Remember that at one point I said I actually needed 17 orders of better resolution. Well, one question that arises in string theory, well, that 17 or 18 orders really came from matching Newton's constant and the string scale. It turns out that string theory, though, really describes Newton's constant in 10 dimensions. What we measure is Newton's constant in 4 dimensions. Those two are related by, it turns out, this compactification geometry, and in particular, the size of the extra dimensions. And so in certain scenarios, here what I've called the brain world scenarios, one conjecture is that it is possible that, in fact, some of the extra dimensions are large. And in this case, the reason we haven't seen them is that because we're actually confined to one of these brains, we can't move in these extra dimensions. We can only move in the 3+1 that we observe. But gravity or geometry knows about the extra 10 dimensions. And in that case, I can make this size, this compactification volume, or this size of this extra geometry much larger than I might have otherwise expected. And what that does for me then is it says that this 10-dimensional Planck scale or this string scale may actually be much larger than I expected from the naive calculation I did before. And so it could be that, in fact, when I go to the Large Extron, the Large Hadron Collider, that one of the things we'll see is extra dimensions or extra pieces of space-time geometry, extra directions. In any event, if you ask the folks, the experimentalists at the Large Hadron Collider, what are they looking for? Well, some of the leading candidates are then extra dimensions, but also extra particles from supersymmetry. And so there is hope that the Large Hadron Collider could give us some guidance to sort of physics at the string scale or stringy physics. Another direction that's being pursued, and in fact actively being pursued here, is using the universe or cosmology to give us guidance. Remember that, or one of the things you may have heard is that the universe is expanding. So if this is our present day universe, as we move forward, it's getting larger and larger. But if we follow things backwards in time, then things must have been getting smaller and smaller. And in fact, at a very early stage in the universe then, everything must have been compressed down to a size of the string scale. And so down here in the very, very early universe, perhaps strings were manifest. They were just freely propagating around in the full geometry. And then the question is, does this stringy physics down here at a very early stage of the universe leave us any imprints or any relics in the late stages of the universe? And so what we have to understand then is, you know, the optics of our microscope. But our microscope here is, in fact, the entire universe or the cosmology that's ensued from this stringy stage to our present day stage. But there are various ideas on how that could arise. Perhaps, you know, there could be very subtle signatures that we can find in the cosmic microwave background or in the relic radiation from the early stages of the universe. Perhaps there are actually strings that are manifest out there who remain as relics of this early string stage. My real belief is, though, that, you know, these are the ideas that we need about, but what we really need is some clever new direction. We need some new idea if we're really going to make contact between this beautiful string theory that we know as theorists and experiments that we can actually physically realize in the laboratory within the foreseeable future. So that's string theory then, a source of rich new ideas. It's a theory that's still looking for guidance from physical or experimental observation. Another aspect of string theory that you may have heard about is its mathematical nature. So, you know, the language of theoretical physics is mathematics, and certainly string theory is one of the most complex theories that we know about or that we work with. And it's in fact, it draws upon all sorts of different areas of modern mathematics. And so there's a whole list here of different ideas that string theorists have borrowed from string theory. There are also ideas or areas of mathematics where the mathematicians have actually borrowed from the string theorists and developed their mathematics even better. But again, I think this is the fact that there are all these different kinds of mathematics, it's reflecting the fact that we're still looking around. We're still trying to understand what the correct language is to describe string theory with. It's as though we have some kind of intuition, as Einstein did, that string theory or that gravity should have some kind of geometric origin, but we didn't really know about Riemannian geometry yet. And so in the same way, you know, this is a very rich subject. It gives rise to a lot of mathematical ideas, but I think we really need yet another. We need the mathematicians have to develop some wild new form of mathematics to really incorporate or encompass all of the features of string theory. And given that we really don't have the right language, I think the idea, well, we don't really have the full picture of what string theory really is. Remember, I said that we can understand a type 2a phase and a type 2b phase and even an 11-dimensional supergravity phase. And so with the technology we have, we see how different little pieces of the puzzle are fitting together. But we don't really have a grasp of what this full picture is going to be when all of the puzzle pieces finally fit together. And so that may be, you know, we're getting towards the end of my talk, that may be sort of a pessimistic point of view. I actually think it's a very exciting point of view. And so the analogy I want to make is with, again, physics of the last century. It's perhaps easy to forget, but at the beginning of the 20th century, theoretical physicists were actually engaged in a very fervent and excited debate. And it was a debate about whether or not atoms were real physical entities. Some people, you know, made great progress with their theoretical models by introducing the concept of an atom. But then there were other people, for instance, Ernst Mach, who was a leading thinker of the day, who said that it was ridiculous to introduce a concept like an atom because we were never physically going to be able to verify the existence of such a tiny particle. And so it was ridiculous to build physical models that were based on imaginary concepts like that. Well, as we all know now that, you know, he was wrong. Atoms are you know, commonplace. You know, even grade school kids know about atoms now. And in fact, less than 100 years later, it's not just that we realized that atoms were correct physical, or they were realized as physical entities, we were able to detect them. But in fact, in the 1990s, we were actually able to manipulate them. And so here's a construction where some clever experimentalists are doing an experiment, but basically what they're doing is they're arranging atom by atom a set of, I think, 37 copper atoms in a perfect ellipse like this, and then they're placing another atom at one of the focal points of the ellipse. And then the experiment is to see this image or this shadow that arises at the other ellipse because of this one and because of the elliptical structure. And so the way I look at string theory, we're very much at this early stage. We're at a stage where we have interesting physical ideas. It's giving rise to, you know, or it's inspiring new ways to think about the universe, new ways to think about physics. But it's still a long way off from being verified experimentally. And so, as I say there, for superstrings, the adventure is still only beginning. And then I'll just close with, these are some other sources if you'd like to know more about string theory. Of course, the web or Google is the source of all knowledge these days, and so these are some web pages that you might find there. And I think it's on the official string theory website. We have an official string theory website, apparently. But they say it's the 21st century. It's time to feed your brain. And so with that thought, I will end my talk, and I'll thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Myers. We have a few minutes, hopefully. Do we have some questions that people have?
Well, you were ready to ask questions at the beginning of the talk. So
I have a raft of questions. One very simple, quick one. You talked about 11-dimensional supergravity as one more or less equivalent formulation of a whole bunch of other 10-dimensional theories.
Right.
If you lose some information or something, I mean, how do you do that? If you need 11 dimensions on the one hand, don't you lose something if you translate down, projectile down?
It's again a matter of, you know, if we, what I wanted to do is go back to this two-duality picture. So here, at some level, you know, I was describing different geometries. But at the end of the day, what I was really describing, or the way I was going to describe physics on this geometry or on this geometry, was on a common nine-dimensional slice. And what these formulas are saying are that if I'm a nine-dimensional physicist, what I see is a certain spectrum or a certain set of energy scales. But what those energy scales do are they reflect this extra piece of geometry here. And so, you know, in fact, I can't distinguish whether that spectrum is telling me about a big circle like that or a small circle like that. And so it's in a similar way that the 10 and the 11 dimensional theories are related. Well, the way, I mean, it was a surprise when it was first realized, but, you know, when I think about these 10 dimensional theories, some of those 10 dimensional theories, you know, had extra particles in them. And so there was a series of extra particles, similar to what I was talking about there. And so what the surprise was then that I could reinterpret the spectrum here in terms of an 11-dimensional geometry. I mean, the surprising thing is that we actually lose information going this way. But that's just a technical thing, because I just have more technical control over the theory in this phase than I do in this phase. But in principle, what the duality says is that if you properly interpret the physics, all of the physics that's here can be described in by different phenomena or a different set of phenomena in that other corner of this wedge. I know you had other questions, but I should probably.
What do you expect from the new Geneva's accelerator? I mean, what kind of experimental proofs are you looking for or hoping for?
Well, as I said, the most exciting thing you could hope for is to see evidence of extra space-time dimensions. That, like anything else, though, is a long shot. It's perhaps more realistic to expect to see some evidence of supersymmetry at the Large Hadron Collider. But some, you know, the particle physicists are starting, you know, there's an enormous amount of energy that's been devoted to understanding supersymmetric theories and what the phenomenology would be here. But some of my colleagues also think that's a long shot as well. And the real reason to do this is you know, because they don't know what we're going to see at this next frontier. And so the most exciting thing that we could find is something that doesn't fit within any current theoretical framework. That's what would excite the theoretical physicists the most.
being presented with a public like that. I'll go over here.
For those who had the books on the other side of your picture, who did not care for screen readers, what would their major objection or objections be?
Well, I should let them speak for themselves, shouldn't I? A theme that runs through those books, well, a couple of themes. One of them is that, you know, we've been looking at string theory for, you know, since, well, we didn't understand it in the same way, but string theory is an idea that originally emerged in probably the early or late 1960s, early 1970s. And here I'm saying that we're still looking for experimental evidence. We're still looking to confirm that in some way. And so some people, you know, one of the complaint might be, well, you know, you've been working on this for so long, you know, you should have come up with an idea of how to see it in the lab by now. But from my point of view, that's really a, you know, it's a philosophical point of view. And so if some people think this is an exciting way to, you know, push forward theoretical physics, then, you know, we should work on that theory. If other people think there are other ways to better invest their time, then they should try, you know, those other avenues. I'm not sure what else to say other than that.
I'm a concrete thinker, so this will be a simple question.
Okay.
Could you draw what this string of an electron would look like for me?
I understand
that particles on particles, they're strings.
That's right. But it's a matter of the resolution, and I'm missing. Here's a piece of chalk. So if our resolution is 10 to the minus 17 meters, if that's the smallest thing I can see, then a string looks, or an electron looks like that. So that's what it looks like.
So it could be that.
But if I look, you know, if I'm able to look at it with, 18 orders of magnitude better resolution, what you would see is something like that. But that's not really a fair way to draw it, because it's a, it again is something that's governed by quantum physics. And so in the same way that, you know, when I drew the electrons around the atoms, I didn't draw my nucleus here and then draw an orbit like that. But rather somebody made for me a nice picture of some hazy cloud that was evolving around. In the same way, you know, I can draw pictures like that, but those are really classical pictures. And if I take into account quantum physics, you know, this structure gets smeared out. But what you would start to see is that, you know, there is some physical extent to the object. But what I'm trying to say with that fuzzy thing is that the string doesn't have to be at any one point at a given time. Rather, just like the electron cloud here, it can be smeared out. So at some level, I'm being a little bit glib. That's a set of words, but I don't think I gave you the picture you wanted. But perhaps the idea I'm trying to express is that you shouldn't expect for an electron to see a string like that. There were other strings that I talked about, or I mentioned in passing, these cosmic strings. So the idea there is that the cosmic string, it was a little string that was sitting around in the early universe. It got caught up in the expansion of the universe and got stretched out to a macroscopic size. So now we're talking about a string that spans, you know, distant scales where quantum physics is less relevant. And so in a case like that, what you'd actually expect to see is we're not talking about an electron anymore. We're talking about something called a cosmic string. Mm-hmm. But what you'd expect to see there is a geometry. It's a line in space. And what this is describing is, you know, the effects it has on light passing by that string. But in a situation like that, you do get to draw a classical picture. But when I'm talking about an electron or a muon or something like that, it's not really fair, or you can't really expect to draw a classical picture of a loophole tiny loop.
Sorry, if I could just follow that up. So we don't have any evidence that the geometric properties of quarks are different than electrons, as an example?
We're
not seeing some as circles and some as lines.
Not at the present day. Rather, what we have today is a catalog, you know, and they all have this point-like geometry. But implicitly, the way I distinguish them is because there's a bunch of labels. You know, if I have an electron, one of the labels is the electric charge, so it's -1. If I draw an up quark here, I think it's +1/3. If it's a down quark, well, it might be 2/3. And so these different labels are things then that I'm going to be able to describe or manifest in, you know, there's a, well, again, maybe it's not fair, but if I have a classical picture, you know, if I have a string that vibrates, you know, like this, you know, in a certain way, that would be associated with this charge having a particular value. And if it vibrates more or less, it would have, you know, these other values. So we certainly do distinguish these different particles, but the labels we use are just, you know, numbers or coupling constants. But the idea is to reduce that down. In string theory, you would want to reduce that down, and those labels would become associated with these internal degrees of freedom. But we don't, I don't yet know, I can't tell you how to do that in detail yet.
Thank you.
How about next?
How constrained is string theory? Like, you know, are you kind of like importing a constant from this experiment, plugging it into theory, or do all the various masses and the interaction strengths and all that kind of pop out automatically? Do you understand my question?
Yeah. In some sense, it's there are, in principle, nature provides us with a lot of constraints. In practice, when we're working with string theory, we're not very constrained because we're really working in a regime that's beyond the regime where we're doing the experiments right now. And so, in fact, there's a huge amount of freedom in that. I said, you know, I want to curl up 6 dimensions. So I had 6 extra pieces or directions to go in the geometry, and I want to make a small geometry. You can well imagine that, you know, if you set your mind to it, there are, you know, tons and tons of different ways, tons of interesting geometries you can make. And so that sort of geometric aspect is where the extra freedom comes from. There's actually a huge number of choices, and in fact, we don't really know which is the right choice to match up to what I call the standard model of particle physics.
There may be oodles of different ways you can do it, but there's each of the various ways giving you the facts that we know about the universe. Or do you have to, shall we say, artificially put those in by hand?
No, what I'm saying is we're not even at the point where I can put them in by hand. I would like to, but what I know, at a very simplistic level, what I would say is that, you know, I know tons of geometries and I know how to curl them up. But in fact, what I'm getting is something that's close to the standard model, but it's not the standard model. And so, in fact, I know that you know, those large set of geometries that I know about aren't right. And so I'm still looking for the right set or the right family of geometries to go for. Why don't we go to the back?
Just a conceptual question. Is the wave function you write for, you know, let's say for an electron in standard quantum mechanics, it's got to be related to the vibrational frequency you're talking about of a confined string. Are they the same thing? Just the equations you write for the vibrational modes of a particle, are they the same as the wave function you would get in quantum mechanics?
Well, the short answer is no. But the longer answer is that there's a relation at some level, but it's at a more abstract level, and then I'm applying the same kinds or the same sets of ideas, but at a different level of abstraction in the theory. I mean, it's somewhat like going, but one of these slides is going to show up. It's somewhat like the level of abstraction in between going between quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. In quantum mechanics, you talk about a single electron, and you apply a certain set of ideas. There's a wave equation, there's a wave function, and it's governed by certain physical principles, but it's one electron. When I go to quantum field theory, what I'm actually saying is, well, an electron itself is an excitation of a field, and so I can excite one electron or two electrons or any number of electrons.
But you're still right. It's quantum field theory is just a modification.
It's an extension, right?
Field theory from a Schrödinger equation. I mean, you start adding on the symmetries to get to quantum field theory.
Yeah. Right? So it's an extension to go from here to here. And I still apply the same kinds of ideas that I developed here. Now I'm not describing a single electron, but I'm exciting sort of excitations of a field or a whole any number of electrons. In the same way, so the connection I'm trying to draw is in the same way of going from here to here. Here I went from one to many. Here I'm applying, in some sense, the same ideas, but now to the the internal degrees of freedom on the string. And so here I've got one, here I've got many, here I've got many collections of degrees of freedom. And so you're applying the same kinds of principles, the same kinds of ideas, but the complexity of the system that you're describing is increasing at each stage. So
how do you describe collapse of a wave function in string language?
So, well, I would not. But I'm told, well, no, okay. No. String theory doesn't answer, questions like the measurement problem. I'm no better suited to answer that question than somebody, who's just studying quantum mechanics. So that's an area of physics that you don't gain any insight into. At some level, what you can do is say at low energies, this turns into this, turns into this. And so if I can solve that problem, how an electron, gets detected in some detector, I should really work at it at this simple level here. Rather, it doesn't buy me anything to work on that problem at this level here. Go to the second row.
The reading we did last night suggests a lot about energy and that the mass that was manifest in these strings was so high, it was more than many millions of times the proton. And then it's discussing about a negative energy that dropped that mass back down.
Okay.
I was just looking for some clarification. But
that's a level of that I did not aim for in this talk. It comes at some level from this idea that I was talking about, that I'm, at this level, at first pass, I'm at some, from a certain perspective, I'm applying ideas that I developed here to the internal degrees of the string at this. And so, I've got another 15 minutes, so I'll just keep talking. You can cut me off. But so, well, let me ask you: Have you studied a simple harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics?
Not a lot.
A simple harmonic oscillator is sort of just about the simplest quantum mechanical problem you can do. And one of the things you find is that if I ask what's the energy of the ground state, you might think that the energy if I had a piece of chalk, you might think that the energy is zero. I mean, classically, what I'm doing is I'm drawing a potential energy that's just a parabola. And it depends on the position, and so this is the energy. And so classically, the energy goes to zero here at the when I'm sitting at the origin. But quantum mechanically, quantum mechanics says that the particle can't just sit there at the origin. It's sort of spread out. And as a result, the energy isn't quite zero. It's a little bit more than zero. And so what happens then is that when I have a whole collection of internal degrees of freedom, each one of them has a tiny little contribution to the energy like that. And so if I have a huge collection, then the ground state energy isn't zero. In fact, it's that huge number times the tiny energy. And so I think that, I'm just guessing, that that's sort of this huge energy that you talked about at the beginning. But sort of consistency of the theory actually tells us that, in fact, that wasn't the whole story. Consistency says, for example, that a graviton is a massless particle. I know that it doesn't have, you know, a mass of whatever, a billion GeV. And so it turns out the consistency of the theory says, well, actually, you got this picture a little bit wrong. It turns out that the zero point, you know, I implicitly said that zero on my potential energy was zero here. But in fact, I got that scale a little bit wrong. Zero should have been here, or zero should have been somewhere else. And so it turns out that, you know, this shift in the energy actually moved it from some negative number up to zero. And so well, as you can imagine, I'm cheating a little bit, but the idea is that, well, the first idea is there are lots of internal degrees of freedom. They all contribute with a certain zero-point energy or a little bit of energy in the ground state when you think about it naively. But then internal consistency of the theory tells you that, in fact, what you were doing was not shifting it away from zero, but shifting it up to zero, so that at the end of the day, the ground state, or say a graviton, actually did have zero energy.
So we're just over time for lunch now, so I give Rob a break. And hopefully he will be able to stay around for a few minutes if you do have any questions you weren't able to ask. But thank you very much for that enlightening presentation on string theory. I know it was a topic a lot of people were asking about, so as a token of our appreciation.
Oh.